Hello, everyone, and welcome to an as-of-yet unnamed Discworld podcast project. I am one of your hosts, Quinn.
And I'm Ludo, the other host.
So, Discworld podcasts, these things exist, and I'm not sure that any of them are going to feel quite like the thing that we're presenting here, because, for one, I haven't read Discworld at all. This is my first time experiencing the thing. And, two, I think that we're going to be engaging in a critical mode of analysis that isn't the approach that a lot of other podcasts take. Suffice it to say. I should probably say what Discworld is, shouldn't I? For people who might have found this and are listening to a Discworld podcast, but for some reason don't know what it is. Maybe you've been attracted by one of our radiant personalities, but Discworld is a series of comedic fantasy novels by the late British author Terry Pratchett, which explores the eponymous Discworld largely as a lens by which to sort of pan or make commentary on the genre expectations, structures, tropes, and that of fantasy at the time, which I think is an interesting thing for us to sort of unpack contextually. I don't know if we want to do that right now.
No. And that's the thing that probably is going to be more conventional, because there's a whole aspect of analysis that is intrinsic to the series, and that's the most straightforward analysis that people do, is that they look at the analysis that Terry Pratchett did at the time, and it becomes kind of calcified in the moment, and it is served as slices and kind of trivialized in the definition of accumulated knowledge. There's a lot to get into the weeds, and I think you can expect that from a lot of other Discworld podcasts, and you can even see different type of lens. Even some more academic lenses of Discworld, there are people that are more equipped for that. There are even people that give a supposed leftist read on Discworld, and so on. So for a straightforward read, I think it is a field that is saturated. And Discworld has been extensively studied on that way. It's a long-lasting series that had a great impact. And because of the way it is open to the discussions. And that is exactly kind of what we figured might be the unique angle, is that Discworld, by the way that it is, and it is analyzed, it creates very important discourses. It is a series that is not static in time and allows us to have this communication with what the text says, what the ideas in which the text was inserted was, and how those echoes can be applied when we examine it from our current cultural and historical place. It is, by definition, a very living document. And it is supposed to be a comedy series for the great part. And the problem with the comedy is that it tends to age like milk.
Yeah, it really does.
I think the best signal of there's still something of value on comedy is if it still inspires jokes today. Because I think the best jokes are the ones that have a transformative potential, which we see on the age of the internet. That's the whole thing when you get down to it with memes and memetic ideas, is that the power of repetition and the power of building jokes on top. And if we couple that with the unique talent of Discworld at creating these spaces for discourses and how interested the tests themselves are in engaging in these discourses, coupled with the jokes, we are supposed to have a very fertile ground for new jokes and new angles to which to engage with these discourses.
Exactly. There's something about the speed and culture of the internet and the production of memes that is like a rapid fire discursive process. You wind up with these memes that shift and transform and acquire associations and counter associations so quickly that are built out of this sort of social relation or this social process of humor. And I think Discworld is doing something relatively similar, which then frames it in an interesting place where it is speaking both to the past from Pratchett's perspective, to the contemporary from Pratchett's perspective, and it still echoes forward to where we are. Speaking right now as I've read the first section of Color of Magic. That's all that I've taken in so far. But there's ways that in engaging with the text, it sort of creates this multifaceted engagement with bringing the past present and the present past. It's a very interesting, fertile place for discursive engagement, like Ludo says. But also, we don't want to get completely like up our asses in terms of getting super, super academic in that sense, because I know at least for me, that's certainly an impulse. But bits are fun, and that's the way that this discourse is forming. And it sort of makes sense to meet that discourse on its own terms. So to like get kind of funky with it. And I like that.
Yeah, it's like Quinn says, it has its own kinetics that it's unlike anything. And at the same time, it kind of preceded the kind of kinetics of humor of the internet, even. I have to say, going back to the books, they go down dangerously fast. Reading them with ADHD is a danger. I often have to reread stuff 3 times because I just keep going. I have a weird heterodox standard for what I consider art and the value of art. I really don't like to force into people, but it's enough to say that when something makes my synapses fire, the way a text like your average Discworld novel does, that's really something that I find satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
I get enjoyment that I don't get only in the acts of the consumption of the art, but how the negative space in which this art thrives and the ideas that fire. And we talk about that from both great art and awful art.
Yeah.
And I think 2 examples that come to mind was how I keep playing Disco Elysium in my head are the verse in which what is objectively an awful piece of art, the nightmare that was playing the Pathfinder Kingmaker video game.
Yeah, we both have a history with that game. I know that there's some people who really, really like Pathfinder Kingmaker. I'm not one of those people. I played it for 300 hours. And I kept going because of this way that that negative space and the way that it was discursively engaged with the genre space and with social dynamics of culture beyond the fantasy sort of genre or the CRPG space. It was terribly compelling, but it was not good. It was very, very bad, in fact. And yeah, in the same way that I sort of keep going back to Disco Elysium, which was really, really good, I think Discworld has this sort of, I feel weird assigning like the frame power to it, but there is something about its construction that I do find very compelling in the spaces that it both creates and opens up to think about. And it's, again, it's like Ludo says, incredibly easy to read. I was worried, and I actually think, speaking of reading it with ADHD, the fact that the book, the first book that we're reading here, isn't particularly structured. It has 4 sections and no chapters. It makes it really easy to just sort of burn through a section because I need the chapters to pace myself otherwise, because it creates a natural breaking point. And here it just keeps going. And it's like, oh, it's really easy to read and leaves me thinking about things after the fact, both sort of, I guess, for good and ill, if we're going to assign those valences. There's ways in which it seems like precise, accurate, and incisive, and other ways in which it has so far missed the mark in a way that is very compelling. It creates a very fertile ground for engagement, like away from the act of reading the novel, which is interesting considering how the books are largely existing in a production context. Like the material production of the thing is one of disposability primarily. But again, I don't know if we want to talk about that quite yet.
But I have to say that aspect of approachability, I think it's very important and accounts for the popularity of the Discworld, especially among non-native speakers, because everything is extremely approachable, even with, like, sure, there is a lot of obscure things that nerds love to go wild about and howl and hoot, but at the basic level of interaction with the text is extremely accessible. And it actually goes back, interesting, to what Quinn said about power, that if we talk on a postmodern idea of power, in which power is the ability of control which discourses are allowed to happen and who is able to take part into them, there is both a lot of power across the entire Discworld universe over more than 40 books. And again, approachability that allows a lot of discourses to both happen and more people to engage with. And I think it has a more, how to say, I don't want to use the word democratic here because they are still very tied to old imperial notions of the Imperial Core, but, well, they are an open door for more ideas, which I think it's where the ability to have these conversations both with the past and with the present and with the future give this very unique space. They are an actual pretty good way to see how people can get involved into this and why people are not able before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
I think that's the great virtue of them is exactly allowing these conversations to happen. They are powerful vectors.
And there's one thing that I know is sort of on my mind. I'm also curious about the way that, like, Pratchett as a social force or, like, as a, you know, as a cultural phenomenon plays into this, especially in our contemporary age, where we find him, at least I have found him often, like on Twitter or whatever, positioned as, in light of J.K. Rowling being incredibly anti-trans and actively funding and engaging in activism that is violent toward transgender people, he winds up getting positioned as the alternative. Like, there's a discourse that states we need a quote-unquote British fantasy author. And it's interesting because I imagine that to an extent before Harry Potter, and I can only say that I imagine because I was born in 1993, I sort of grew up in the Harry Potter era, Pratchett existed along those lines. But in the same way that, for example, Stephen King is sort of the archetypal American novelist of a particular mode of novel. He's not like the great literary American novelist, but he is this sort of pulp, or not pulp, but popular horror-inflected novel sort of figure. Rowling seems to have grabbed that valence for, like, British fantasy authorship. And now that her star is sort of waning, there's an impulse that I've seen to replace her with Pratchett, and explicitly to replace her with Pratchett because his politics are quote-unquote good.
Yeah, I think it's actually pretty important to get into this because, to be frank, a lot of the drive that convinced me that something like this project actually has value to contribute is because I kind of want to resist seriously to this approach to media.
Yes.
It's dangerous. I don't want to use that word because it has used lost all meaning, but toxic, it is, let's be honest, it's harmful to our media literacy. It does not represent reality. It seeks to reduce everything to slots and pieces of art that fit that slot. And there is, like Quinn described, the fabulous, famous British fantasy overlord that they want to remove Rowling from, and they want to slot in Terry Pratchett. Uncritically, without appraising why the works of Pratchett work the way they do, why the works of Rowling work the way they not, never questioning the shape of the fantasy British overlord and what social function it exerts.
Exactly. That's the thing. Like, there's not a question of the production of this thing, of this idea that this has to be the case, and the way in which putting someone in that position discursively exerts power. Like, it creates a downflow of power and social relations and conceptualizations of art that, again, it's toxic and very, very frustrating. Because art can be a lot more than this thing that you slide into neat little holes or like that you like slap a clean label on. And there are uses to the labeling function, right? Like assigning labels, developing taxonomies, that can be helpful in terms of developing like an understanding or what have you. But I think I'm not on board with this impulse. And I know that some of that is like from, it sounds kind of funny to talk about this in terms of like who gets to be called the popular British like fantasy author, like overlord. But there is sort of like an ethical dimension to it to me in terms of how it sits with how I conceptualize or would prefer the world functioning, where that allows the function of, I mean, it's a hegemonic function, kind of. Like, it creates this solidified, unified, sort of crystallized conceptualization of a canon or a space that a medium inhabits or a genre inhabits that then imposes itself on other works and other artists operating in that field, which, as we talked about, like opening or closing discursive doors, it starts foreclosing a lot of those discussions.
Yeah, and I think that echoes, well, you don't have this feeling because you have not read the books, but from my end, having experienced the books, knowing what the texts actually contain and what they do, and because, again, I believe that they have the potential to open these courses, to see these used to close doors and to take, no matter what you might think about the books or Terry Pratchett, to take something that has a lot to say and even more important, allows things to say and use that to fit the form of the works of someone that has not contributed anything to the opening of these courses, that has literally nothing to say other than the most neoliberal, centrist, blue labor, run-of-the-mill, hegemonic British imperialism reproduced over and over. And the only thing that she has to say, well, is hate. She's completely masked off. And you do the liberal mathematical appraisal of works and decide that you can replace this problematic fave with this, you did the math, and this is a less problematic fave that you put there. And look at that. You have 40 books which you can glorify. You can make the treatment, take lore, and present these lore pieces that then people can consume. You wash your hands and your work is done. You done an art, and that's all the interaction you need with art, and you just want to look forward to the next piece of content.
And that's a huge thing that you're getting at right now. It creates a reader who engages with art minimally. Like, they come into contact with the art, or the art comes into contact with them, and because it's already sort of sitting in this enshrined space, it sort of disincentivizes a mode of engagement with the work that is like active or critical in the sense that you are considering what's being said as it's being said. Instead, you just sort of like let yourself flow through the work or the work flow through you, which is it's disappointing, I think, to say the least.
Yeah, it's a way of relating to art that I cannot relate to, I'll say.
Yes, exactly. For sure.
This is a good jumping point because I think we should talk about our experiences with Discworld before.
Yeah, for sure.
I think what you're starting to say probably crosses over with the way that you have experienced Discworld since the 90s. I'm someone that has not read Discworld, but has been for sure exposed to it.
Yeah, yeah. So,
especially now that he's being propped up in the discourses.
I've been aware of Discworld for ages, like probably since my like mid to late teens. Like I've just sort of been aware. And I think that something that's interesting here is also to sort of inform you with my social location, in a sense here, is I grew up, especially in that time of my life, my mid to late teens, I was spending a lot of time online on forums, especially as they relate to tabletop role-playing games. So I spent a lot of time specifically on the whitewolf.com forums in the Exalted subthreads, but sometimes in other parts of the forum. And in the same way that Monty Python sort of is used as a signifier of nerd status, or it creates sort of a, sometimes it uses or occupies a social function in nerd spaces that I've noticed that allows people to sort of signal to each other an awareness of a thing, especially something that's funny, and they can just sort of parrot back the funny thing, not because they don't have the capacity to generate humor for themselves, which I think is sometimes a little bit of a skeptical read on this thing, but I think that the function instead is to ease social tensions and to let people know that there is sort of like an alignment of personality. Granted, that tends to become here an alignment of consumption. You're signaling that you're cool or like you're not like a threat because you have consumed the right thing, which I think is a function to be critical of. But I see that being a function that's used as well as to sort of create a shared language that people are able to engage with. So when you're engaging with like fantasy spaces, the sort of specter of Discworld is present even when you're dealing with something that is, in the way that Exalted is, sort of positioning itself intentionally against the wave of like British Western fantasy literature, even though it doesn't always necessarily do it that successfully. But that's neither here nor there. We're not here to talk about Exalted. So I become aware sort of Pratchett at this point. People are always talking about, people love the Guards novels, the Night Watcher. See, this is a thing that I'm like, I don't have all of the language because I haven't actually consumed it. But people love the Guards. People love Vimes. People are always citing these novels, I feel like, in particular. And I never got around to reading them. They sounded sort of like typical fantasy dreck that like, I just like, okay, it just, again, it's sort of in the same way that like, yeah, I saw Monty Python and the Holy Grail and like, it didn't really do anything for me. It didn't grab me. I don't necessarily want to read what is being used in these spaces essentially as like a Monty Python novel. I'm not necessarily interested in that. So I sort of never actively engaged there. And as I like, got older, again, it continues to occupy this sort of social space. I hear a little bit more from people who I know that I have like a little bit more in common with in terms of interest or I guess taste. Sometimes we'll mention them positively. Again, it's a lot of citing the Guards novels. I feel like I wouldn't be surprised if there's people who understand or would expect from an outside perspective Discworld to be the novels about a fantasy city watch, because that is what everybody talks about. Except that, like, at some point I knew that there's a guy named Rincewind, and he exists, and he's not involved with that stuff. So I stayed with my brother for a little while in, like, late 2016, and his boyfriend had a bunch of the Pratchett novels, and that is the closest I ever came to reading them. I think he wanted me to, like, he recommended Soul Music as a place to start. I don't know if that's any good. I see Ludo just sort of like made a stink face, is like, what? But I never got into it. It was a chaotic time of my life. I didn't really feel like I had time to be, or the energy or focus to be reading novels. And then, yeah, we sort of moved to this sort of space where in what, the last 4 or 5 years? Well, oh, actually, Pratchett passed, I think, in 2015. And that got it was 2015 or 2014. He passed in like, I know he passed sometime when I was in my early 20s. And that created a bunch of conversation about Discworld. Largely people just like praising it. And I think this might be the time in my life where I became aware that there was a character named Granny Weatherwax. I'm like, okay, it doesn't sound like she has any relationship to the guard stuff going on. It sounds like she's sort of in another space in this configuration. And then as Rowling's star declines and there's sort of a resurgence of leftism in America following 2016, sort of in the lead up to the election there with the rise of Sanders and then the Trump administration and this combination of people sincerely moving like quote unquote left and the sort of hashtag resistance trend. But I start seeing Pratchett cited in terms of, oh, look at how well Pratchett's prose captured like the realities of the difficulties of capitalism. Like here in this one little like paragraph or two, he has enshrined or like made clear how life is different for rich and poor people. And this I would say is the somewhat like famous slash infamous Boots passage that I started seeing going around a lot more around this time. And that more or less brings us to present where, again, I've seen this tension, this push and pull for Pratchett to sort of occupy this space now that Rowling isn't appropriate to sort of like replace as this hegemonic symbol or ideological map for what British fantasy is supposed to be. That's like right up until we started talking about what might make this podcast happen and how it could come about. So yeah, what's your story, Ludo?
So my story with Discworld is actually pretty weird because, first of all, I had my first contact with Discworld completely divorced from Discworld. So there was this not very good point-and-click adventure game like Monkey Island that was Discworld. It was basically a rough adaptation of the first two books of Discworld series, and you control Drainswind going around, clicking stuff, getting around in this stereotypical goofy fantasy city with completely absurd puzzles, like what people joke about the developers' logic on those kinds of adventures. I think that was probably the pinnacle of the completely out of their logic, and I don't even know if I actually finished those games.
And it's interesting when you speak about like the context in the discourse, like the discourses that are around. Pratchett almost gives permission to push that in directions that might seem funny, but I can imagine instead actually being just deeply frustrating.
But that's the thing, that's important. It gives you the permission to get frustrated, which is something that the most outer functions are extremely hostile to.
So hostile, yeah.
Especially, again, the Turfing Chief is extremely hostile to that. And yeah, that was my first contact with Discworld, and I had absolutely no idea that there were books, that this was an important part of the nerd discourse or whatever. This was just a computer software that... It was a charming little world, and it was had enough charm that you could tolerate the puzzles. And then I basically forgot it for a decade or so. And so growing up, there was this sense that there was these pieces of fantasy culture ever since I started playing D&D and whatnot when I was 13 that floated around, and they had novels, and they were basically replaceable one for another. Mm-hmm. I look at the Dragonlance, and I look at the Lord of the Rings, and they were just these blobs that replace one with another. At the time, I was reading in French a lot of old Forgotten Realms novels, and I just like, yeah, these are just dropping pieces of lore that can be replaced by another. That's it. And most of the nonsense that it came because I usually associated with these prep kids from the medium high society that went to the English and the Dutch schools that were usually the people that had access to these things even. And these things were extremely important to them. And for me, that was able to read these in different languages, and the ones that I was getting were the ones that I found on the flea markets, and they just, you are considering what it is way too serious than it is. It's, they are extremely generics. You can slot in one space with another, and just look at this. I made a campaign setting that has pieces of all of this nonsense. Mm-hmm. They just slot in one into another. You can. They are made for this. They're just made for this immediate consumption. So I never took these extremely serious, and I never was able to get my hands into a Discworld novel. So in my mind, I did not even associate with the game that I played when I was 9 years old. I thought, well, that's just another of these countless things that you just slot in, and never gave it any thought. When I joined college, on my first year, I had a more contact with these things, and I actually found myself with a lot of free time in my hands. I did not have to do farm work on my free time. I did not have to work on construction or in factory. Weirdly enough, I had the most free time that I ever had in my life until that point. And I had access to a lot more books than I ever had. At the time, my roommate, he had a massive collection of Discworld books. And also, he was a cinema student, so also he had easy access to a lot of these things that are basically the movies that people that were into cinema in the early 2000s were into. So I started with that free time. I started reading both the first book of Discworld because, hey, it's here. This book is pretty thin. It's not going to be a big loss. And I started reading that and Dune. I never finished reading Dune. I read over the next 3 months, I read like the 32 novels that were printed at the time of this book.
You're not going to believe what novel I have on a table in my house with a bookmark 100 pages in. It's Dune.
Let me guess. It's when they are in the tent in the desert having the weird talk and visions.
Not yet, no. I it was like right, it's still pretty early in the novel. I think that Jessica and Leto had just had a conversation about placing a paint. And it's because I had this intent to read 100 pages of Dune and then flop to one of the essays in On Kings by David Graeber and Marshall Solins. And that didn't wind up sticking. I need to get back to On Kings. And Dune is of critical interest. I'm having a lot more fun reading Discworld than I was having reading Dune.
That was exactly what happened. And by the time I got to Jessica and her twin son in the desert, I was starting the third book and was like, well, it seems much more interesting and dealing with very similar topics, actually. And yeah, and the only time I went back into Dune was exactly when I got to Pyramids, which is going to be an awful ride once we get there again. Let me tell you, that book almost made me stop Discworld entirely.
Based on the 88 pages or so of Color of Magic that I've read, you said the novel's called Pyramids? I think I might have an inkling of why that would turn someone off.
Yeah. Oh, yes. And again, the duality of Pratchett. It has one of the funniest bits on Discworld is on that damn book.
But we will be talking about that duality. It's so, so strange.
It's extremely strange. But I had the privilege of consuming a lot of these novels in a relatively short span of time and divorced from nerd culture at large. And this was also my Anglophile period, in which, well, I was an Anglophile. That was also this time when I consumed Monty Python and etc. And I seeked to understand the culture of the Overlord, because for the European space and the face of the Imperial Corps is more the British than the Americans. So getting access to this world was kind of something that I got. If I understood their culture, I could perform in that space. There was the lure of that. And again, because they are who has the access to the things back home. They are the ones that have access to the six-star resorts. They are the ones that own all the vineyards and around the place. They are the ones that are the owners of all the companies which everyone work. The British space was one, if I was to have any application of that, especially if I was to work on applications of my scholarly knowledge, I will need to be part of that world to some degree. So it's no strange that both my academic development and my Anglophile face develop at the same time. Because at the time, the pinnacle of my achievement would be eventually to move to the UK and be able to perform at the high level academic there. And again, all these things, they were not divorced from that. And my enjoyment of Terry Pratchett was in great part because it was a very approachable entry into that world. And I think a lot of the British media that I consumed at the time would be completely impossible to understand nonsense without this first step. So that was an angle which Discworld served, which imagine my surprise, because that time was also when I started interacting the internet with nerd spaces. How weird the idea of Discworld is for people. And you start to wonder, did these people read the novels? Because they seem to have got complete different notions that I got from them.
And that's something I definitely want to put a pin in, because I feel like we have to discuss the function of fandom and how that can be like an interlocutor in the process of reading or in the process of like your continued understanding of work after you've engaged with it first time. Because I sort of see quote unquote fandom at work there in some ways.
Yeah, I think that's especially it. And that did not lead me to interact with the fandom in Discworld. So I'm pretty neutral. It's the most polite way that I can say it. Towards nerds reading of Discworld, especially how much that seems to be obsessed with lore. And I know that's going to be extremely fun already on the first episode, but well, that is also the question about fandom, because fandom is all about cutting pieces of work into bits of lore, which then the owners of the IP throw as much lore as possible to reward you for your fandom, and that's neatly tied on a movie or a TV series or a book, whatever, and then they show you a future piece of lore that will come out in 1 year, and then they have you chase that it again, fill it with another pieces of lore, and keep feeding the hogs the slop. Mm-hmm. That seems to be basically what fandom is a lore recognition machine, and it's trapped on this Skinner box of pellets of lore. And Terry Pratchett, because of how easy the writing is, how dense the writing is, for how approachable it is, which is something that very rarely happens and is a testament for his skill. It has a lot of things that you can make lore. And that is how most of the nerds interact with it. And that is a very strong potential for a Discworld fandom, which probably is why they want to slot him in that role. And again, if this is what is going to happen to it, it does not bode well for Discworld or the Discworld creators that are going to be, or the Discworld readers, in fact, as well as possible Discworld creations that might come with this.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you really accurately sort of identified the concern or the critique that I have of fandom as like a lore recognition machine, where that sort of super, like, which is interesting because it points toward the potential in some cases for a form of like the critical faculty that I think can lead to useful analysis. You can see how things are connected. You can see the ways in which they relate to one another. but you've limited that scope so drastically to only what exists sort of like within the text, or sometimes not even within the text, but within the like the popular canon, which, yeah, I find that very frustrating.
I think I really have nothing to say about that, because that's basically the state that I ended with. So I read everything about that time. So around 32 novels. It was probably the last one at that time was one of the later Watch novels, which are not even not fantasy cop stuff. And then I got into my PhD and also got over my Anglophile phase. So I was suddenly very busy and tired of that. Besides, I had a lot of Italian stuff to read in the Italian language. So that fell to the wayside. And at the end of my PhD, that Terry Pratchett's plans to deal with his conditions were came to the public. And I realized that that was it. That was also the work as he wanted to be done. And I figured, well, I want to see how this changes and how the last novels are. And then I started reading once again Discworld. And I was surprised at how well they hold up and how some old ideas they were interested. And I think I stopped on Raising Steam. And I think there's still a couple more that I did not have the time or opportunity to go back to read, and probably going to be this podcast an excuse to get there fully.
Yeah, in the long arc of when we arrive there in the Pratchett canon, which is definitely sort of, I think that also points to something that is of interest with the structure of the podcast, that especially when we talk about the calcification of works through the combination of authorship and this sort of like singular fantasy overlord role, one thing that we're interested in doing is undercutting that in many ways by watching the development of Pratchett and how Pratchett sort of, again, I don't know that I want to say Pratchett, how Discworld sort of comes to be Discworld, right? Because even then I'm sort of like leaning so heavily into the authorship idea, which there's ways that we can talk about Pratchett, but I also don't want to sort of undersell, or I don't want to conflate Pratchett with the work that is Discworld, and I also don't want to locate Discworld as solely being the product of Pratchett, because even novels that are written by a singular author tend to be brought together by a team of people, like editors, and so that's just me being incredibly self-reflexive, which is maybe a habit that I have from professional training, or just other interpersonal like histories, but we're interested in looking at the way that Discworld takes shape and the ways in which specifically it is coarse or tense or contradictory.
Well, I know that I am extremely hostile to author theory in any form, mm-hmm. including even Death of the Author. I found extremely harmfully author-centric. Mm-hmm. So whenever we touch the shadow of Pratchett, I am honestly only interested to see what he's doing as an author function.
Yes.
Because it is going to be what helps shape what kind of discourses are happening there. And especially, Pratchett is really good at this. He is kind of the reverse Stephen King in this aspect, because like King is a sponge. He's a bottom feeder. He takes everything that is coming and processes and makes it and assembles it into biomolecules and becomes its body text. Pratchett is extremely sensitive to the vibes around him and transmits them on the text, but at the same time does not try to be as tone neutral as possible, but still in a way which allows those discourses to happen and you to interact with that moment. So he's no Ursula Le Guin, But a thing that I think that both of them share is that Le Guin, she has this amazing ability to converse with her own work. And so she never really feels like an author. She feels like she's in conversation with that. And when you go into her long-term series, especially on Earthsea, you can see how much she is really no different than you on her interpretations of the text. She's on this conversation with this, and she gets this from it, which creates this universe of discourse that then you can interact, and you get the feeling that the gaps between the texts are giving you permission to do these things. And this is a really rare thing that she does better than anyone else. And I think Pratchett is probably the closest person that I saw in having this relationship. And he really claims no ownership over the Discworld. And he seems to be very interested to see what stories the Discworld has to tell to him. Mm-hmm. And he's basically witnessing these things happening and then doing bits about it. And what is extremely fascinating and where I think he has an edge over Le Guin is that he can literally take anything else, put it through the Discworld, and let it have its dialogue basically hands off. He managed to, by the openness of the Discworld, that has both a framework, but also a willingness to break its own rules all the time, it's professorial resilient, but also why it's so comedic that people are trying to apply canon to this.
Mm-hmm. I can't speak to that too deeply because of my lack of engagement beyond this very small piece of the book that I've read so far. But I think that makes sense. And I definitely agree with your framing here of looking at Pratchett through the lens of like the author function, because what is of interest here is, okay, so when was this thing produced? So in what context was the thing made? And what is the text itself communicating or saying, or, and how does that relate to, again, we're looking at this not as like an isolated thing, but as a thing which speaks across time. So how is it speaking across those times or to those times without necessarily relying on or committing ourselves to like a framework of like intentionality or even like singularity, which isn't to say like anyone could have written Discworld or what have you, but we are interested in how this thing is sort of constructed out of its social contexts and how it constructs social contexts, sort of speaking into the future. So yeah, sometimes like I will have a tendency to say Pratchett. Often what I mean when I say that is the text, because I don't know what Pratchett thought in his head or felt in his heart, but I see what's on the page and I see the way that it relates to other ideas and like other histories and contexts. So I guess I just want to clarify that little bit of my own use of language, because we live in a culture that is so saturated with the focus on the auteur that sort of discursively, the way that discourse colors our readings and the way that we, you know, formulate even spoken language, I find intrudes upon what I'm trying to say at times. So especially if I'm speaking extemporaneously, you'll find that I am sometimes going to say Pratchett when I mean the work itself.
Yeah, I think that can be a thing that we announced when you are listening to the actual podcast. We're going to say Pratchett probably a lot again as this short one, but it's kind of silent and assumed that we are talking again. Text and the discourses, the text is engaging either on its own moment in time or with the recent times. Because again, seeing it as a living thing, which has no, Pratchett has no more control than anyone else. Mm-hmm. And this speaks a lot to the duality of Pratchett, which again, it's not really about Pratchett. It's because a lot of the times this duality comes with him seeing the notions of the space in which he is inserted and playing with them. Mm-hmm. And in the process of playing, he reproduces them. And this is what causes a lot of groans. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it's also no accident that those tend to go with the most shining examples of Pratchett. Because again, Because when you play in the mud, you're playing in the mud.
You're going to get dirty, yeah.
And, yeah, you're going to get dirty, and there's going to be a splash of mud around.
Right, and to formulate, like, part of my stance on, like, the duality of Pratchett, because when we actually start talking about the novels, this is going to be coming up a lot, but to explain it from, like, a zoomed-out perspective without calling on any particular examples here, I find that he's often engaging with a discourse or, like, naming a discourse, locating a discourse, locating a dynamic or relationality, and it feels like he's really onto something. It feels like he's quite accurately describing a phenomenon, a relationship, a discourse, what have you, a material relation sometimes. And as he's doing that, I can almost imagine there's a bar at the bottom of Terry Pratchett's screen that's like the British soul meter. And when he fills, he's forced to say some of the most like head ass, ridiculous British shit that you can imagine that it undercuts it. It's not a deflationary move. Like, he's not releasing tension, or the text isn't releasing tension. It's just, it's a lot of the time it's baffling because the reproduction seeps in. Like, oh, you're taking it apart. You're taking it apart. You're looking at the pieces. Oh no, you've put it back together and it's horrible.
Yeah, it's the Discworld buzz moments, I don't know, or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. But at the same point, again, we want to have a more dynamic and interesting interaction with the text. The point of the podcast is not to cancel Pratchett. In fact, if this is what you expect, okay, Pratchett is canceled, or for whatever that means, as if that is an actual real thing with material effects. If you want to hear that, yes, Terry Pratchett is canceled.
Yeah, he fucked up many times.
Okay.
Sure. Yes.
Yeah.
Because again, we're interested in what that produces. Like, what tensions does the duality of Pratchett sort of produce? And what does that say about the Discworld, the past, the present? Like, in what ways can we... I described this in a conversation I was having with Ludo off the podcast as these tensions create sites of critical intervention. Like, they allow us to step in because you see the crack. And you can kind of tear it open and like look at what's happened and sort of describe that. And as a reader, you're serving a function. You're bringing your context. We're not like objective about this stuff. We're engaging in discourses, bringing our own discursive context with things. So that creates a site where we can have a conversation. Essentially, this lets us, you know, sort of talk to the piece. And that's what we're interested in. We aren't interested in saying, well, Terry, that was. Do you really want to say that? I mean, there's a little bit which we might say that, but that's not the end of the thought. We don't terminate the thought there. We then continue to sort of break down what's actually occurring, what we understand to be occurring, and we allow ourselves to sort of become interlocutor.
Yeah, and again, we spend so much time complaining about the slotting in. This would be the same. We would be taking the same approach of getting the good stamp and the bad stamp and going around stamping. Mm-hmm. And as much as we complain that just putting the good stamp on Pratchett and sliding in over the rolling empty space, because rolling not that bad, getting the bad stamp and putting it on Terry Pratchett would be the same, the same criticism and engagement with art that we are criticizing. Mm-hmm. And again, what would be the usefulness of this? We don't find this useful. Oh, no, wait. There's actually a very good use. You see, when you are in the ride with the Lich King, Lizzie II, when she changes phase after 25% of damage, she summons every knight that has sworn fealty to her. And if they have a canceled debuff, it really undermines their DPS and gonna make the ride much easier. So I guess it's useful to cancel Terry Pratchett on that aspect.
Yeah, it'll make that entire second phase a lot easier. There's actually some speedrunners have used it to generate some interesting combos. We're not trying to speedrun Squirreled here. So, but if you do find that personally helpful, that is a strat that you can bring with you that fight.
I think it's interesting going back to the thing that we supposed did at the beginning of this episode, and actually I think we did a really poor job, which is to explain what Discworld is to people.
Yes, exactly. I was so high level. And like, again, I was describing it as the person who hasn't engaged it, really.
I think you grabbed a very nice idea about Discworld becoming Discworld, because I can tell you, going back to these first books, this is not Discworld. This is not what Discworld becomes. So at a surface level, Discworld is a fantasy or place. It is a silly little universe that is a disc that sits on top of four elephants, that sits on top of a turtle, and the turtle goes to space. That is the most superficial idea of the world. And then it has all these almost platonic versions of places that you might know from fantasy. Mm-hmm. That is the most surface thought. And that Discworld, that already existed from the beginning. But that is not what Discworld is when people think about it and what Discworld becomes. Because as it encounters feedbacks, well, it becomes a world about stories. It is, this world is a universe where the most important thing is story. And I don't mean the self-masturbatory circle jerk of the end of Game of Thrones nonsense. I mean, it is the construction of, this is a world where the most important rule is narrative. How will that world behave, and what world stories happen in this world, and how will people live in this? That is what Discworld quickly becomes, and what really makes it interesting to interact with, especially, and why it's so interesting from the point of view of discourse analysis and from understanding humans. If you see humans as the ape that tells stories, this is a world about of stories and where stories actually shape reality. Narrative is the strongest force in this universe. So this allows you to explore a lot of things about the ape that tells stories, as well as creating very interesting spaces for discourses to happen, because the premise of social constructivism is a law of reality on this world. So even if you disagree with it, mm-hmm. if you have different notions of epistemology and formation of knowledge into this world, this is literally true. And perhaps it plays a lot like with this and makes it very fun. And it allows you to, again, it is very accessible for you to interact with these ideas without having to read the nightmare that is postmodern literature.
Yeah, right. Because it is, it's a surprisingly like post-structuralist, social constructionist thing to create a world that is predicated, or like that is like sort of ruled by the logic or the construction of stories. And it sounds like, again, this is a thing where I have to speak from my place of ignorance, relatively. It also sounds like, especially some of the framing that I've seen in what I've read and some of what I know about the other thing, the other books that are at play, sometimes it seems like he's able to engage in this like discursive evocation. I don't necessarily want to call it discursive analysis, but he evokes these discourses. He brings them out by looking at people in the world who aren't necessarily sort of the archetypal heroes who have the stories told about them. It seems like there's this interesting confluence of the logic of heroes and stories brought to the lived experience of people who are not that. But I could be mistaken and overreading based on the very little knowledge that I do have.
So I think that goes back to the point of what Discworld becomes, because Discworld has the germ of that on the early books, but it only really develops later. But it tends to be about, again, as you say, people that usually their stories are not told. It's very rarely that you see a classical hero archetype, a king, any of these, a prince, a noble even, any kind of people in a position of authority. And it's very rare that they actually are a protagonist in these books. Probably the closest to that has to be the City Watch. And even that, well, we're going to have to put a pin on that when we actually get to talk that on when we get to those books. But yeah, it tends to be about, air quotes, regular people, and stories happen to them. They get tangled into the narrative of the world, of whatever that novel is about, and now they are heroes of a story. And they want to bring out their discourses of their existence and the discourses in which the position that because of the discourse of the narrative of what is a hero is expected to do, put on that place. And then we have the dream of social constructivism, which is multiple discourses competing with each other to defining what a person is.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, again, it's the mother load. It's what, if you have this interest, you want to see happening. And that is what is this world.
Yeah, it makes me start honking. I absolutely start hollering because I love that. Like, I have such a vested interest in that from my academic background. And I guess that's also professional training. But also, I find it such a compelling framework for understanding and analyzing both media and the world, like as it unfolds, social relationships. So I'm really excited to sort of get in the mud there.
And again, this is extremely rare in fantasy. I think I can only, the only other example of this that I can come is the later two books of Earthsea. Again, to bring Le Guin, because on the last two books of Earthsea, you see these old dynamics about gender, about how being an archmage, being a high priestess, and being a woman, and being a wife, and being a widow, and being a mother, and being associated with power, and losing that power, being a dragon, being a girl, being disabled, all those things always in a turmoil, and people struggling to be themselves in this, and eventually literally fixing the world in the process of becoming themselves and engaging with the discourse. That is what Earthsea does so powerful. That is literally the only example that I can see compared with that. And again, Earthsea does that in two books, which took the space for this happens took almost 20 years for even for Le Guin. And Discworld amazingly keeps doing this every novel as soon as it gets started, which again, it's extremely impressive.
Yeah, it's very, very compelling. Like, I've only read the small bit. There's so much to latch onto, so many little things. So should we shift to talk about what's coming up? Because we're intending to read this. I don't think we've actually stated this. We're going to be reading them in chronological order, in release order. So we're starting with The Color of Magic and working our way through. And that's interesting because I've mentioned this a couple times on the different people, and almost everyone stops and says, no, don't do it. You have to start here. And I've gotten a bunch of different answers for that. Like I said, I was told Soul Music. I've been told Mort. I think I've been recommended Hogfather. So here's the thing, because we're interested in the construction and of the becoming of Discworld. So that's interesting. I'm also the person who played Pathfinder Kingmaker for 300 hours, saw how bad it was, and was compelled by how bad it was. And I didn't even turn that into a project. I could have taken that and I could have written an essay or 100 essays, but I didn't. I did that for my own edification. So that's what we're doing here. We're starting from the beginning. We know that it, quote unquote, gets better. Whether or not it's good is actually kind of immaterial to the entire undertaking.
Yeah, we kind of went to get into the mud too. And yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
It's actually that it's not good. It's actually better. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Yeah, because again, I keep telling Quinn this. I have really trouble interacting with a piece of art that is seen as perfect.
Mm-hmm.
It's beyond critic because it just does not give me anything to latch on. It's like, okay, what am I supposed to do with this? Yeah.
It slides off of me. There's, in fact, to go back to memes, right? There's a meme that's been going around lately that is like a picture of a hamburger that has a very large hamburger. It's one of the largest hamburgers I've ever seen. There's a lot of individual slices of patties for the hamburger, and they're all labeled 10 out of 10 element of, I think it started with video games, or it started with an anime. So it was, you know, like 10 out of 10 writing, 10 out of 10 characters, 10 out of 10 like opening, 10 out of 10 animation, 10 out of 10 action. And every time I sit down and I like look at one of those, it just like starts dripping off my brain. I can't name it because, and this is sort of like a reputation that I have. I love things that are 6 out of 10, sort of, because they tend to create these tensions that allow for the application of the critical function. Like they create these opportunities for engagement where something that is a 10 out of 10 can make you think about something, but it's a very different way of thinking about something than these tensions tend to bring out. And I like living in those tensions. I find it really compelling, even if sometimes I do have to shower after I've spent a bunch of time in the mud.
Let's keep it even out of the discussion if this 10-10 everything down the line art exists.
Mm-hmm.
Assuming it exists, I feel like me interacting with it actually tarnishes it if it was like this. If I cannot do anything with this, if it's just something that
mm-hmm.
I am supposed to let pass through me and be in awe, but somehow does not have edges, which I can be transformed and the art can be transformed in this process. I feel like attempting to engage in a discourse with it, again, it degrades the art. It puts me, which for virtue of being a material being is not 10-10,
mm-hmm.
I'm diminishing the art. So whatever I experience, it's not going to be a 10-10. So I'm experiencing something that probably someone that believes that the 10-10 art exists will call divine, as close as something can be ontological perfect. And I have no desire to interact with this even, because I will only diminish it if it exists, while any art, the 9.9 art, has enough edges, which if I show vulnerability to it, if I let the art transform me, if I engage with it, I get more appreciation of the art than the sum of its parts, and I bought myself. I feel that it was good for me to experience this art. Well, anything that everyone says it's perfect and no flaws is like, okay, then me interacting with it or not literally changes nothing. Nothing about me and nothing about the art. And I have no interest in that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly. And yeah, I couldn't say it better myself. Yeah, so is there anything else that we need to cover here in this intro?
I think we need to tell how the podcast format is going to go, which as best as we can, because well, we still have no idea. And that is kind of what you can expect.
Yeah.
We are not sure if we're going to have any recurring segments or structure. We're going to be tackling this on a more informal way. And
mm-hmm.
we are going to have basically one book bleed into the other. So, because again, we are more interested in discourses. So we're going to kind of flow that. And we, in these first books, we have parts. So we might try to hit one part each episode, but we don't have the benefit of that later. So what we're probably going to do is we're going to see how much we have something to talk, and we're going to go full discourse on this. So even if the text is not much, but allows for a lot of discourse, we might have to read an entire book to have an episode, which, considering how dense the writing is unlikely, or we might read 20 pages and that be it.
Mm-hmm.
If you are planning to read along at home, I'm sorry, this is going to be extremely hard for you.
Yeah, especially because it's sort of going through this discursive process, reading too far ahead can create complications of its like of its own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think basically that's going to be it. I hope to say that ideally we're going to be reading like 100 pages of a book, talking about it and going on. But It is not locked into stone. We don't know how it's going to go. Again, we don't know which thing's going to be something that we're going to keep an eye on between books and going to make recurring elements of the show. Again, we still don't even have a name, so...
Right, we're...
You know what the name is because you're listening to this, but we don't know.
Right, we have some ideas, but we haven't locked anything in stone, and it... Again, because part of this is the process of engaging in these discourses, sometimes what's going to happen, like theoretically, as we continue to engage in these discourses and we sort of develop these discourses that we're sort of like dragging along with us in our knapsack from book to book, that can both like expedite and complicate the process of reading things. So we might wind up with certain books that we don't find are particularly discursively interesting in certain ways, or that we find that the ways in which it is discursively interesting has already sort of been covered by the collection of discourses we've already sort of like pulled out and played with. And that's sort of what makes it unpredictable. Because chances are this first episode we're going to do, we'll cover the first two parts at least of Color of Magic, because based on I've read the first part, Ludo's read through the second part here for the podcast, and it sounds like as dense as the first part was, there might not be as much of discursive interest in the second part, but who's to say about parts three or four? We don't know. We're feeling out the vibes. Again, it might calcify over time. We might find ourselves having created discursively a structure which we must now contort ourselves to live inside of, or we might avoid that and keep things loose. So I guess like buyer beware.
Yeah, that's it. We cannot make promises because we will breaking them if we do.
We're both really good at that, I think, in terms of we're going to find the thing that interests us and we're going to like latch onto it fiercely. And sometimes that means getting really, really in the weeds. And I think that we'd sort of prefer to get in the weeds, to get dirty, to get muddy for an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours. I think that's probably long for an episode, instead of reading a whole thing and being like, oh my God, we have like 6 hours of things to talk about.
Well, and because you know that... knowing ourselves, if we did that, we will be getting still on the weeds. So it would still be 6 hours, but we don't talk about all the things we wanted to talk because at some point we obsessed over one thing and keep going.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. We both got ADHD. We both have like these frameworks and you know, we sort of bounce off each other in that direction. So I think that this will be a more productive form for the criticism to take. As frustrating as it might be for someone who craves structure, we're not the podcast for you in that regard. We can't promise you that.
But to be fair, if you crave for more structure, I, from what I've seen, there are pretty good podcasts that take a more reviewer approach. They every month they crack a book, read it from one to the end, do a summary, and discuss the themes. And I think. Again, it goes back to the why of this project. It's already so well done for so many people on that aspect of this more reviewer approach. I think a more critic approach is actually what is pretty lacking. And I think we both, because exactly our ability to get in the weeds, we can actually offer that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Like, for example, we're going to have a lot to say about Thatcher's Britain in the first section of Color of Magic that I don't know if anyone else has really like talked about that context or like really looked at and like pulled apart some of that stuff. And like, I'm not a British history scholar, but I have a sense for the shape that neoliberalism has taken like over Thatcher's turn and whatnot. But like that is the sort of thing that you can expect instead of what is this saying about like about money, again, like in an almost ontological sort of sense, or like what are the declarative statements? Like, what are the themes? Like, because themes are of import, but we're not necessarily interested in just reporting back what the themes are. We're going to get in the mud with them.
Yeah, exactly. If we see a theme, we're going to start discourses with it, with how that theme looks in 2022, rather than whatever this theme was calcified through this specific lens in 83. No. If you see a theme, we're going to engage with this as we are now and see how it was engaged at the time.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. And yeah.
Yeah, and that's it. So we're going to see you next time. And we're going to see you at least for part one of Color of Magic, which is named Color of Magic. Maybe we'll be seeing you for the second part of Color of Magic 2, Ascending of...
Yes, exactly. So, yeah, be ready. We're going to talk about your boy Rincewind. Everybody loves Rincewind. I can't say that with my whole chest. Rincewind's a complicated character, and I look forward to talking about him.
No, fuck Wizard Buzz.